Today's program was brought to you by New York Wines, reminding you to eat and drink local this Thanksgiving. For more information, visit newyorkwines.org.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good evening and welcome to Fun About It on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I'm Mary Izette.
I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And we're your co-hosts through this weekly journey of all things fermented.
Archived on Stitcher, iTunes, and right here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
So we're in Bushwick, Brooklyn at an Airbnb with...
Sebastian Sauer from Freigeist Bierkultur.
Awesome. It's very exciting to be here. We actually met you last year when you...
Crashed our wedding.
Yes.
It was like, looked like the Who concert afterwards.
So tell us a little bit, I guess let's start with how you got into brewing or how you got into beers.
I started brewing 12 years ago, starting to drink specialized beers. So I got pretty much on a website, which would be like a kind of a German version of Rate Beer. And so they were like talking about like different taste descriptions and stuff, and I was kind of surprised that people were like writing so much text for the description of taste. I was 17 at that point, so didn't have that much drinking experience yet, and I was collecting coasters when I was a kid, so I knew a lot of brands, and I was like, oh, at this time when you're like 1 year pretty much after you were allowed to drink legally, you're like, oh, it's like so many brands, and I actually have no clue what beers, how they taste. And everyone like in the class is like, oh, has a different favorite. And so it's like kind of like, oh, I want to know what my favorite would be about. So I was like kind of like interested like when people were describing stuff, and I wanted to get more knowledgeable about it. And so I pretty much went to a drink store, got like a mixed case of different beers. And
Were they German beers or?
It was mostly German beers, but it was also there was a Berliner Weisse, for example, which I definitely remember. There was a Grimbergen because I was born very close to the Belgian and Dutch border, so the border triangle. And so we got a little bit of Belgian beers over there, and then the rest was like pretty much German mainstream beers. And so it was like very, I invited two friends so that we have like some different beers we taste together, and the taste experience was very, very mixed, you know. So we hated the Berliner Weisse, for example, which is nowadays one of my favorite styles, but just like we all spit it out pretty much because we were so shocked.
Do you remember which Berliner Weisse it was?
Yeah, it was Schulteis, and it's like they stopped brewing it, so
they
and I'm like, oh, I was so unexperienced, and I'm like, I spit it out, and now they are close. what a jerk, you know. And so then that situation, and then some of the stronger beers, they are kind of interesting and stuff, was just like, yeah, no taste experience at all pretty much. And so going from there, and then like, I don't know, I was like going on mostly on my own, tasting more stuff, while the other friends were like, oh yeah, it was interesting, but we don't want to focus too much on it. And so it's just like going on and like going to the drink store again, buying different beers again. At some point you can't find any new beers around there, so traveling a little bit more. First time going to Belgium for like, oh hey, completely different beers. And it kind of started with going to Maastricht, which is the Netherlands. It's like a very city close to the border. And I was going to some for a beer festival, which was mentioned there, and they had like, oh, kind of like you were able to meet the brewer people, and also the beer cafe situation, and you're like, oh, so I kind of like walked inside, had maybe 200 beers at that time, maybe, and it's just like, oh my god, all these beers, and you have no clue of any of the beers and what you like, so it's like a lot of challenge again, just like tasting more. And so it's like kind of like, oh, and then went to Belgian beer festivals, met a lot of Americans also and other people, and like, I don't know, I remember a Great Divide Yeti, for example. Wow. I saw the bottle, the old style bottle was like kind of like, oh my god, like who's packaging a beer like that, and which is very, very different to all the traditional beers
like
we
the
had.
22 ounce bomber bottle?
Yeah. Exactly. It was like the snow mountain on mm-hmm. it and stuff. It was just like the name and everything I saw it was pretty cool, and just like a lot of different beers, a lot of different experiences. And that was like very, very interesting. And also the meeting the people. And so I did this pretty much for 5 years until I decided to start doing something professionally about it. So when I went a lot, this time I was going also to Denmark for beer festivals or like to Italy. And I saw a lot of people were asking me, oh, hey, can you bring me this from that trip? And can you bring me that from the trip? And I'm like, it's just like, yeah, it's like kind of weird that we don't get any of these beers in Germany or nearly no. And so I was like deciding to do, first of all, also import of certain beers on a small scale starting, you know, so mm-hmm. just like combined with an online shop. So I was like starting to import beers from De Molen, Cantillon, that kind of stuff. And all people like Prefontaine, like Armand, is like, oh, Sebastian, it won't be possible to sell goose in Germany. It's like, that's a big challenge you are starting here. And it's just like, oh, yeah, but I will try. It's like, I'm not depending on the money or stuff. I just wanted to do it. Just wanted to make it accessible pretty much. And for brewing, it was for me very, I was not interested to making pale ales or stouts, which were around, which were good, which I like to enjoy. But I was interested in the beers, which I couldn't find anywhere, and which I found his recipes on descriptions in all brewing books. So, for example, my very first beer was Abraxas as a Lichtenhainer, and it's like, oh, Lichtenhainer, that sounds interesting. And it's like, at some point, it used to be round and it used to be a sour smoked wheat beer, so sour, smoky, amazing. It's like, love both. I'm curious how both together taste. And from my experience, or from what I know, maybe there was something somewhere, but I didn't know any sour smoked beer at this time. It used to be right. Something in the past. Nowadays you can find a lot of other interpretations, but that time it was for me something completely unknown. And I was like very happy with the result, and just like, okay, going on small scale and stuff, until like some people like, oh, that's great stuff, we want to get it to bring it to Italy. And like at some point Shelton Brothers like, oh, we want to get it to the US, you know. So growing pretty much with the demand, and was never at the beginning the idea to make a living out of it.
Right, but at the beginning, so you went into the brewing part of it after importing.
No, it was pretty much at the same time. I was teaming up with a friend of mine who was running a brew pub, and I was like, I got quite busy with it before already, like, and I had a lot of taste experience, but I pretty much started at this time in that way. So I didn't have a hobby brewer background so much. So I was just like, okay, I got busy. Oh, the way it works and stuff. And we were like kind of like brewing together for the first batch, and then just cool. like making more and more out of that.
Yeah.
Cool. And where, so you talk about, I know we'll talk more about your historical, your interpretations of historical styles. Tell us a little bit about how you go about and how you've been going about researching these styles. What kind of sources you're using? Where are you finding these recipes?
You can look in a lot into archives, for example. So there's like obviously, I'm sure it's the same in the US, where you, when you know a certain book, you can look up where you can find it. And we have that system in Germany, for example. I would go and like, oh, I know, and there are like three known examples of that book, for example, and one is in Munich, and one would be in Berlin, and one would be, let's say, in Hamburg, and everything would be quite far away. I could request to get this book shipped to my library to get have access to it and copy stuff out of it and so on. So that's something which you can totally do. And there are also certain informations which are like digital available as well. And there's a lot of different books. It depends on the time you look into. Everything, I would say, before the 18th century is rather superficial. So it just gives like, oh yeah, you kind of, you know, like they expect you to know in general how things are done, which you obviously nowadays don't know how they did this, but it's just a kind of like, yeah, it's like, yeah, you need to use this, you know, it's like, it's kind of clear what, how much amount you need, want to use, but it's like, so it's a little bit more difficult to recreate that, while especially in the 19th century, it gets very detailed, so they mention concrete or precise measurements, and they are like old measurements, so you pretty much need to do the conversion into modern measurements, and some is like very different, so it's like it's not always the same. So at this time, for example, before 1871, Germany was like a group of different states, mm-hmm. counties and stuff, which were not united. at this time. So the different kingdoms and counts and stuff. And so they all had a little bit like their different systems. So it depends on where the...
different measurement systems.
Right.
And
yes.
Different units. Ah, interesting.
And then you need to look also for example, nowadays, obviously we have the metric system, but then it's like, okay, we have like kilogram, and kilogram is like a unit which is means the same. And in former times, yeah, a lot of times it was like about the volume. So if you have like one Berliner Scheffel, for example, which is an old measurement, like one Berliner Scheffel of wheat wouldn't be the same like one Berliner Scheffel of barley, because it's the space it takes away.
Right.
It's different.
Because it's the weight.
Yes. It's so Berliner Scheffel was kind of like a bucket where you're like, okay, I can put different amount of kilo into a bucket of barley or like or wheat. And so you always need to take this in consideration as well. And then I thought it was very interesting to have all these different recipes and to see what's going on. Because nowadays in Germany, but also in the rest of the world, people always believe, okay, hey, you guys always had the purity law and all your styles are pretty much what we have nowadays. But this is just not precise. It's not true, because in former times we had way more different styles. And yeah, one of my favorite books is like from 1831, for example, and it's like a regular wheat beer outside of Bavaria was brewed with sugar, beet syrup, ginger, juniper berries, and salt, which is like, oh, nowadays people would be, yeah, hey, I kind of made something like that. But it's like, yeah, we used to have that in the 19th century, you know. It's like, it's not something like new fancy craft brewer shit, but it's just like, it's like something which has a historical meaning. So people were like creating it over a long time to have it like that. And there were like certain thoughts about it. It was not like, oh, it's like a fancy recipe, or like, hey, that could be only tasting good. But there were also a lot of different other considerations in creating recipes.
How long have you been open as Freigeist, and how many beers have you done at this point?
I started in 2009. Mm-hmm. The number is difficult to say. It's like because it's a lot of times it's like certain one-offs, also a lot of brews in other countries. There's like different beers which I do again and again, and which are like kind of like in a regular portfolio. But I don't really think in ways like having a regular portfolio. Right. The demand is around, yes, for sure. I can definitely brew it again, but I'm always interested doing also other styles. But it's depending on the situation we have in Germany. When I started in 2009, we didn't have any craft beer bars and bottle shops. Not at all. Nowhere in the country. And this didn't change for a long time. Mm-hmm. So now we see certain changes. But for example, in the city of Cologne, which would be like this biggest city in my area, would be a little bit more than 1 million people in the middle of Europe. And we just had a bottle shop, the first bottle shop opened July last year.
Wow.
The first craft beer bar opened 3 weeks ago.
Wow, that's great.
With 15 drafts, and that's a major change. So thinking of me like being 7 years around, this is the first place to have my draft beer on all time.
That's
in a way like really, now someone starts in the US and like, but you have like a regular sales on draft. I didn't have that for most of the time, so I was always depending on okay, who needs what kind of beers. Obviously now it's like, oh, this guy and some bottle shops to get special beers made, so I can redo them, and I'm happy to do that. But that was never so much the situation for me in the past. So it's always necessary to be flexible, to change and modify your whole concept and your philosophy. You can never get stuck and say, "Oh, that's the way it works, and this will be the situation in 30 years as well." Because then I'm sure you will go out of business.
So the beer culture in all of Germany is changing that direction.
Yes, slowly. Mm-hmm. Definitely no comparison to the US, because you guys started way earlier than anyone else. You started the whole movement. So Europe would be more slow in comparison, while a lot of countries are really booming and exploding about it. And but Germany is still very very small situation. It's like mostly you can only get the macros, and you pretty much need to know where you can go to get like certain beers. And a lot of areas it also doesn't make sense to have so much craft beer selection, because the beer is very good from small breweries. They just have great lagers, probably some of the best lagers in the world. Mm-hmm. Very, very good pricing. You know, we're like, oh, €1.80 for half liter, which is an amazing price. So trying to tell them, oh, you should try these fancy, sometimes good, sometimes not good. Yes, you know, it's like, oh, crazy flavors and so on. And they will cost like €5. People, it doesn't make sense to them, you know. And I can understand that. I would never try to talk them into having something else.
Yeah. We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back with more Femen About It.
Femen About It.
Thanksgiving is a great time to support New York farmers, including local wineries. Find great white wines, red wines, and rosés from Long Island, the Hudson River region, the Finger Lakes, and beyond at New York City wine shops and restaurants. This Thanksgiving, New York Wines is proud to partner with Fleischer's Craft Butchery, which supports local farmers raising heritage breed turkeys in New York State. With a healthy dose of ingenuity and a collaborative winemaking culture, the number of wineries in New York has grown exponentially over the last 10 years, as has the quality of the wines they produce. New York is a world-class wine region offering quality, variety, and value. The perfect trifecta for a bountiful Thanksgiving feast. For information on more than 400 New York wineries, please visit newyorkwines.org.
Okay, we're back with Sebastian Sauer.
Of Freigeist Beer Culture.
And, oh, I want to ask you about, so I think one...
For men about it.
One thing about Germany is that you guys had a lot of, historically speaking, different regions had very different styles, correct?
Yes.
Is that what you found true? And what are some of the more unusual styles that you came across? You mentioned the one with beet sugar and ginger.
Yes.
Juniper.
And salt, yeah.
Yes. No, but this is not only referring to Germany. That's pretty much, all over beer area in Europe, not necessarily in Italy or stuff, which was historically always more dedicated to wine. Mm-hmm. And we have also some areas in Germany which would be way more about wine than about beer. And so you have, like, if you go to Franconia, for example, you have, like, one village is making the change. So in this area, you have, like, still breweries and, like, making people drinking more beer. The one next village is, like, completely dedicated to wine. It's definitely true that you have, like, different styles all around. And quite a lot has changed, obviously, also within the time. You know, I mean, this is a normal, regular fluxus that not everything is, like, always alive. People are always upset, like, when something dies out, and it's always obviously kind of a pity, but a lot of it's depending on regular change, you know. I mean, we have, like, nowadays, if you go to some of the most historical places in Bavaria, they will listen to American music instead of typical Bavarian music, and this is also something which dies out or is at least getting very limited, but it's always a question if this is bad or not bad, because otherwise you don't have really, like, a change. And then you're kind of stuck in the situation, so it's always up to the, yeah, it's always a question if it's good or not. In Germany, we also had a lot of changes about styles, so sometimes when you look into different times of when books got released, beers had a great reputation and lost them at some point, or the other way around, that it got really good. A lot of it depended on the area where the beer was made, what kind of ingredients they could source. And for example, hops used to be very expensive. So in my area, which would be the Rhineland, was, for example, a very rich area. The Romans arrived there at some point. So the Cologne, for example, is, like, very, very old. Used to be one of the biggest, at some point, also the biggest city in the German Empire. And so they did a lot of trading and stuff. So they had a lot of resources, a lot of money to spend. So they were, like, kind of bragging about it, just like, oh, we buy hops and we use a lot of it. While the neighboring area was something where the Romans never arrived. And which is, like, pretty much only 1 hour drive away for nowadays when you drive with a car. But a very different cultural background, you know. There's, like, the Rhineland would be predominantly Catholic in the past, and the other one would be Protestant, Westphalia. and different kind of dialects, different kind of people, also different kind of tribes, which at some point settled there, and they would be a more poor area, and they couldn't use a lot of hops, so their beers turned to be more sourish. They also had some, this is like also the area where like some beers like Koid and some crude variations happened, so they were using, and most of it is homemade, so a lot of these information got lost because they were never written down.
Oh, wait, mm-hmm. Before you go on, you said, what was the first word you used? You said gruit?
Koit. Koite was also one of these styles which was brewed without hops, and instead they used different spices and herbs.
So it's similar to a gruit. Is there any...
Yes,
are they kind of... Is there that an overlapping...
Yeah, in a certain way. It's okay. Always it's difficult to really say, okay, this beer used to be like that all the time, because obviously things change, you know. I mean, if you look into old stout recipes, for example, from the 17th century, they contained only pale malt, while nowadays all of us have a certain idea that a stout would be black. The same situation, which I thought was interesting in collaboration with my friend Ron Patterson, Pretty Things. Mm-hmm. What they did, I thought was interesting. So they made like the different recipes from a different time. So they had like the Barclay Perkins was a brewery in London, and they had this creation of, I think it was called X Ale. And this used to be a mild, and showed pretty much the history of mild, while the one version was from original recipe from 1838 and the second one from 1945. So changed. So showed the change of one style within one brewery in 170 years, turning a pale, very hoppy, around 10% beer into what we nowadays know as a mild, like a darkish, nearly not hoppy, less than 3% alcohol beer, you know.
Right.
It's like a lot of these things changed quite a bit, and that's obviously what we had in Germany as well. As talking about the more unique, more crazy beers, pretty much, what I want to recreate definitely, and I have some original recipes for that, is a Braunschweiger Mumme. It's like from the city of Braunschweig, which would be close to Hanover. And that was a beer which used to be very malty, very oily, strong, very high Plato. But when it was a pretty bad attenuation, so it would turn out as a rather low alcohol. And they had a really crazy list of ingredients additionally to that, which contained like dried plums and some different spices and some bark and needles from trees and stuff. And it's like quite a long list, and I definitely want to have a take on that. And this like also Braunschweiger Mumme. Yeah.
Braunschweiger Mumme.
Yes. And so this was also known to be getting exported to the UK at that time, for example. A lot of it got really better with, I think even some got shipped to Asia and got really better through the transport. But it's like very...
So they kind of, it sounds like they almost left it still under attenuated so that it could continue on its travels.
Yeah, in a certain way. Of absolutely. It did definitely change. With traveling, it's reported to get improved the taste. Mm-hmm. And so they had different cities, so different versions. So they had one was called Stadtmumme, which would be the city mumme, and the other one was Schiffmumme, which would be the ship, for the ship. And then the double ship would be the Doppelschiff would be this version, a stronger version also for traveling.
Cool. Now you also have the Monarchy, which is doing more, some of these more traditional historic beers.
Yes. It got a little bit watered down, the whole concept of both brands.
Well, there's a lot of overlap, I mean, it sounds like.
Yeah, it does, for sure. I can easily explain that, the situation, how it got created. When I started Fry Guys, as I mentioned earlier, I did this with a friend of mine. And so he was busy at that time, always also like with the brew pub and with family and buying a house and stuff like that, so which just like took a lot of his time capacity away, and I was like, I need to do a lot of things and so on. And so I just founded the Monarchy to be more independent and to make more own and quick decisions. Mm-hmm. Which is was good for me. And so the original idea was that Fry Guys did modern interpretations on historical styles, while the Monarchy would be about historical recreations.
Yeah.
Always, obviously, needs to be said that with modern ingredients. So I never tried to recreate old historical ingredients, because I always want to make good beer. It should be always a great beer. I'm not making beer just for the authenticity, and it's like, oh, it tastes horrible.
Yeah, for nostalgia. That's how they liked it.
Nobody wants to see that, because if you see in the old the malt qualities, they used to have a very bad...
So going to that, you know, we talk about decoction mashing and modern day of malts. Like, malts are in better condition. Do you believe in decoction mashing, and is it
Standard absolutely
doing? And why, given the modern modified malt?
Yes, it's a different way. What kind of taste you get out of that? You especially I totally convinced about the use of decoction for very malt based beers. So if you brew an Altbier, for example, or Doppelbock, it's absolutely necessary to really squeeze everything out of the malt. It's not about the modern malt qualities are obviously better. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times if you would do an intensive single step mash, for example, that would be quite, you would get close to that, but it's just like, it's still a decoction. I think it's way better. The same situation if you have like the cool down a beer on a cool ship, or if you have open fermentation. These are like more historical equipments, but they just make such a difference in taste, right, which I think is important.
Do you use open fermentation or cool ships on some, or?
Yes. No, I work at 3 different breweries. And one which is closest to me and which is a very good friend, so he has a brewery since 1877, the family, and was always inside of the family, so it's now the fourth generation. And they have, for example, an old cool ship from 1933. It's like a 90 hectoliter copper cool ship, which is like transferring to probably around 70 barrels. Something like that.
70 barrels.
Yeah. So it's pretty big, and they got this cool ship out of the brewery 5 years ago because they needed to build a new brew house, and it was the most northern German cool ship, which was still around. And former times all the breweries had it, and it's obviously quite, it's a lot of work because you need to clean in that, and nowadays with all the modern coolers, it's not necessary to have it to produce beer, but right, it still makes such a difference in taste. And I think open fermentation is even more important about that. So, and now, for example, I think it's a lot of breweries see that also in the US and change things about it as well. I was 3 weeks ago at Dovetail in Chicago, for example, mm-hmm, and they have like a very old vessel from Weinstephan. I think it's more than 100 years old, and they do everything in decoction what they make, everything mm-hmm cool shipped, and everything open fermentation.
Wow.
And you see the, in my opinion, see the taste difference for sure, and that's the reason why the German, the German Doppelbock always have a different taste compared to a lot of foreign Doppelbocks.
So when you're talking about, so when we kind of think of cool ships, I think in America we're thinking of Jester King and
Allagash,
some of these more, you know, funky beers that have a lot of different yeast and bacteria involved. But you're talk about the differences between a traditional German cool ship and open fermentation, and kind of contrasted with this open funky fermentation, I guess.
In history, cool ships were always used for making pretty much what they call normal beers, or mm-hmm, where you would add a certain yeast and having that particular fermentation and not like the wild fermentation. So it was pretty much only this equipment was built and created so that you spread out the beer, bigger surface, cooling down quicker, and afterwards you would transfer it right away into the open fermenters. And so you wouldn't have any influence of any wild yeast. You would try to avoid that.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays you still have certain breweries which work with cool ships for their regular beers. One of the most known ones is Uhrige from Düsseldorf, for example, with the Altbier, which is obviously not funky at all.
Mm-hmm.
So they really use it just for cooling, which was the original purpose, right, of that equipment. Nowadays, as you mentioned, these breweries, a lot of other breweries, also we do, what we started doing is for using it to keep the beer at least overnight, to have a more stronger influence of the bacteria, and not only for the purpose of cooling it down.
Okay, so you're doing it for a dual use. Cooling it down, but also introducing other organisms?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Cool. And when you're doing, let's give an example of one of the beers that you use the cool ship with.
We started working with it, so there's no release of one of these beers. Where we have the wild character pretty much inside. We did the very first batch on the day of the Purity Law, the 500 years celebration. Obviously, a beer not according to the Purity Law. So I had my friend Tilo from Rittergutsgose coming over, and we brewed a Gose original according to a very old recipe. So next to Spruce Twigs, which I also have in my regular Geisterzugose inside, we used cinnamon and wormwood, so it's like recorded to contain that at some point. And we used the cool ship. We did a main fermentation on the cool ship, so we kept the beer for 1 week, so that you all had the Croizen and stuff on the cool ship.
And are you adding yeast to this, or you're just letting it ferment normally, or both?
We used also a yeast. Dörner zur Rittergutsgose, like nowadays, is like a brand which got created in 1999. The brand was dead since 45, pretty much 1945, when the Russians took over the brewery and they brought it to Russia. And my friend Tilo and I think it was the son or the great son of the last owner of the brewery. They said, oh, they met and they're like, oh, let's brew this beer again. Let's have this brand back again and this the style of Gose, because it died out in the 50s. They started to recreate it again. Then in the late 80s, they started again. You know, but it was never of a big success until they 1999 decided to publish it again. And so we still had some old bottles from the time when the last brewery was around, so that was from the early 1940s. And had the bottles sent to a lab. They checked them. They made separate batches with the different yeast, and we checked the character of the different, the influence of the different yeast, and decided for the by far best strain to use in that beer as well.
Cool.
So you said you were just in Chicago. How long is your trip, this trip?
The whole trip will take 5 weeks.
5 weeks. And along your way, you've done several collaborations, and you're doing two in town also tomorrow and the next day.
Yes.
At Kings County Brewers Collective, and then...
Other half.
All right. What kind of things have you made on your trip so far?
A lot of very different beers. But I think the focus was a little bit more on Edam beer this time, because I know it's a beer style which... didn't get so much reputation, and it's not really known in the US, and I think it's interesting to bring out more knowledge and connected with the knowledge also the taste to the people.
So tell us about that beer.
So this would be about like less than 2 hours drive from where I live. It's very half an hour from the brewery. And this is a beer style which died out in the 1960s and was a variation of Alt beer. Nowadays we always, most people associate Alt beer with Düsseldorf, so it would be more the hoppy and dark versions. And then Münsterland, you had, for example, a pale, sourish version of Alt beer, and they had that was one of the strongest top fermenting beers. Around 1890 it was documented to have some versions had 10%. Alcohol, so quite strong, and so it's a strong, a little bit sourish, a little bit smoky type of Alt beer. So I brewed this since 4 years nowadays.
Yeah.
Have two fruited versions, one with elderberries and one with red and black currants. And so a few years ago, probably 3 years ago, I think the BJCP recognize it as a separate style, so they mention it, but most people still have no association with it. There's one version from Hair of the Dog, the Adam, mm-hmm. which is referring to that, but Alan Sprint says on its own, it's like, yeah, I didn't try to recreate it in the original beer. I just heard it was a strong top fermenting beer, so I made that kind of beer, but he didn't try to really look into the details. So his version is, for example, not sourish, which would be not a typical Adam beer.
Cool. So you're doing kind of different versions of these beers at different breweries?
Yes. So I was brewing this, for example, at Goose Island, at Against the Grain, at Hop and Frog. Let me think.
And what's a typical fermentation turnaround time for this beer?
Normally it would be a long lagering, so I have it in the tanks for 6 months.
Yeah.
So it's a very long time until it's lagered, and it's not typically not barrel aged in my production. But it's always interesting to have different twists on this style. Sure. So it's pretty much work with the same base idea with all the breweries, but getting some different feedbacks, and everyone had like, oh, hey, what do you think about doing it in this way or in that way? Mm-hmm. So there will be a lot of Adam beer coming out soon, so people can definitely taste it. And it's not only like, oh, you need to watch out for this one brewery, but for me it will be interesting to see also who did a better job.
Right.
Like,
are you, going to come back to town to taste these?
I will make sure to get a taste of this, because I thought it would be interesting, and I didn't involve any of the breweries into that. That was my kind of like my project on my own,
right,
to just make it and to see, and not trying to, these breweries participate, but everyone was happy to have a stake on an Adam beer, and it was for me always interesting in which way breweries worked and what their thoughts were. So for example, with also with Prairie, I was brewing one in August, and with Prairie and with Goose Island, I want to make a pretty much a historical German style black and tan. So we also will brew a Gose, and we will blend both Adam beer and Gose into this historical
German style black and tan.
Yes,
awesome.
And then the other versions, like Against the Grain, for example, there's, we have some bourbon barrels, we want to give it a little bourbon finish into it, and everyone has like his own ideas. And I think that's
where can people find out if they can get, you know, what kind of all these beers and where they can get them and more information?
Either way, contacting me directly, which would be always a clever thing to do.
You have a Facebook page as well, though.
Yes,
so
yes,
you
yes.
Are
you
Twitter?
On your Facebook page?
Yes. No. It's definitely possible to contact me on Facebook through Freiguys Beer Kultur, or send me a friend request, and I will check it if it's good or not. Or like Sebastian Sauer, or send me an email on info@beercompass.de. Beer Compass would be BIERKOMPASS. .de, and so I can tell directly, but a lot of times it's obviously depending on the breweries, because I'm working on that project, but I'm not involved in the sales. We will see certain amounts in Europe, but not necessarily from each brewery, because when the batch size is not that huge and they can sell it right away in the US, then it makes sense, and not making a huge effort and shipping it all over the world so that it gets older in some other country,
right? And the people,
even though this style would be good to age for some time,
and the people that you've collaborated with all have their own distributors, etc., etc.
Yes.
You are imported by Shelton Brothers, and we can find you Freigeist wherever Shelton Brothers imports. Correct?
Yes.
What about the Monarchy?
Same. Yes.
I have a question, because when we first sat down before we started turned on the recorder, you mentioned an Eisbach tank.
Yes.
So what is that? Eisbach is not typically a beer. Actually, I've never brewed an Eisbach, so I didn't know that Eisbach tank existed. Tell us about it.
We build it on our own, so there's nothing which you can custom made by or something. So we kind of like are busy with the way we want to have it set up. And so it's pretty much an old tank we had, and put like the whole cooling installation inside. And so that we have access to the beer right away, and a lot of times people put it into a barrel, and then they kind of like need to drill through the ice to get access to the beer and stuff. We don't have that, so we made sure we have access to it right away, and then afterwards we need to melt down the ice separately, and which is pretty cool. So we have like, for example, it's a 12 hectoliter tank, which would be like 9 barrels, around that, 8 barrels.
Thank God somebody can do that.
5 inches, 45 Fahrenheit.
It's like 20%-ish here in the general city.
Jesus Christ, why you don't have the metric system. We had pretty much filled it up as a test batch with pills, with an unfiltered pills, with 5%, and we froze it down to 13% in 3 days.
Wow.
So it's like kind of an efficient cooling situation.
And then you said you were able to take off the ice pretty easily.
We have access to the beer first, so we get the beer, put it in a separate tank, bottle it, or keg it, and then afterwards we melt down the ice out of the tank before we can use it again.
Cool.
And so that is kind of interesting. And from the legal situation, as far as I know, in the US, breweries are not allowed to do it, except they have a distilling license.
Right.
But it's possible to distribute it.
Yeah, and you could do it at home if you have a freezer to do it. Not that it's legal for you to do so.
We do have some breweries that also have distiller license. We have one in New York City, actually, and I think that's more, you know, we're going to see more of that.
Yes.
But yes, it's an unusual beer for us to see here.
Same for us in Europe, you know. I mean, there's not many doing it, and most of the time it's like on a very small scale, so the beer turns out very expensive, and not much variation is done. I mean, there's Kulmbacher Eisbock, which would be like, the according to the legend, the very first one, which is a bock beer, which they freeze up. I think it's still less than 10%.
Right.
And then they have from Schneider, the Aventinos. They make an Eisbock out of that one, which is, I think, 11, around 11 probably. And so that's pretty much the variation. Other breweries are making the same styles, so you can, I like this or that more. But I prefer to also do very different styles, you know, just like brewing right away like a 10% beer and just freezing it out and to bring it to a higher alcohol, and then you have like very different taste experience because the texture is also changing a bit, and obviously the intensity, because everything you freeze out, what you have, what is left afterwards is just absolutely blunt ice water.
Right, so what you said before, you can use it again. What are you using it again for?
The very first one I made was a Mango Goza Icebox.
Mm-hmm.
So it was called Mango Unchained.
Mango Unchained, there you go. Well done, well done. And so, then what did you use the ice?
So it's interesting to have like a sourish fruit beer, for example, in that way, but it's just... And again, it's just like if you have a lighter beer, contains more water. Mm-hmm. So you lose so much compared to it. So it's always makes more sense from the logic to have a stronger beer, and you freeze it even more out. So I also want to do imperial styles and stuff. Now I have a strawberry wheat beer, which I will freeze out. For example, it will be called Strawberry Icebox Forever.
Nice.
Well done. And stuff like that.
So I have to ask, you're using...
That's none of your business. I'm sorry.
Ingredients that are outside of the purity law, but there's special permission, correct? So just tell us a little bit about that.
A little bit, okay. about the purity law, which is important to know, is that it started in 1516, what I think nearly everybody knows. But it just was a law in Bavaria. Germany has 16 different states. Bavaria is one. There are 15 other states which are not referring to Bavaria necessarily because that is important or something. You know, it's like something is getting legalized for you guys in North Dakota,
right,
and you not necessarily care about it somewhere else. And that's pretty much the same situation for us. So, and a few decades after 1516, actually the authorities said, it's also possible to brew with caraway and with bay leaves, for example. So it was never 500 years around. There were always excuses. And that is still just talking about Bavaria. So all the other states, except for Baden-Württemberg, got it a very few years before. But all the other states just got it in 1906.
Okay.
So for us, we have the purity law since 110 years. That's the reason why I said earlier, the wheat beer was brewed with sugar beet syrup and stuff. Our traditional beers were not necessarily brewed according to the purity law. Nowadays, people say, yes, we have these great lagers and stuff, and thanks to the purity law, but you have great beers in the traditionally, historically, in Czech Republic and in the UK and stuff as well, and they are also a lot of times brewed according to the purity law, even though they don't have a purity law. It's just, okay, if you don't need anything to add, it's great like that, but you should have the chance to brew something else. And so since 1906, you can only brew to the purity law. In Bavaria, they have the strict purity law, which means you can't brew anything outside of the purity law. Even if you export the whole batch, it doesn't matter. You're not allowed to produce it. And outside of Bavaria and Baden-Württemberg, which would be the 2,000 states in Germany, all the others could ask for a certain permission, but they need to ask the local authorities if they are allowed to do it. And they officially, they can only do it if they can prove that this kind of beer has been around before, because this law was created for all the styles which were around before, and that you can still continue to produce it. So if you say, oh, I want to make a beer with coffee, and you can't prove that there was a beer with coffee before 1906, you're officially, you couldn't get this license.
Cool. Wow. So the historical aspect is what's allowing it to.
Yeah.
Officially.
Officially.
Yep. I like gray zones.
Where are you tonight? Well, you have a couple of events in New York City tonight.
The Owl Farm.
The Owl Farm.
Yes.
Which is a great bar on 9th
South Park
Street.
Slope, yeah. Park South, Slope, South, South Park Slope. Slope, yeah.
Yes. Tonight at the Owl Farm, so that will be good. Been there a couple of times.
Yeah.
So it will be nice to go there for an event. And then, as you mentioned, two brews coming up. Then an event at the Chico's Brewster.
Right, they're great.
Shala and Vibro.
And tomorrow night you'll be on our sister radio show of Beer Sessions with Jimmy Carboni.
And then where else are you going?
Great, man. Jimmy, I love you.
Where are you going after this? After New York?
Philly.
Philly, cool.
Yes, it's my typical way. Going down New York, Philly, Baltimore, D.C., only this time D.C., and then afterwards Baltimore.
Cool. Well, thanks so much for talking to us. Enjoy the rest of your trip here.
Thanks so much. Thanks so much.
It has been a pleasure. Thank you so much. Yeah. For men about it.
For men about it. For men about it.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening. You clutch to your burden, her water.